If you're a kid at home this summer trying to stay cool, nothing beats jumping into a pool. But for some children, that pool can be a dangerous place. Drowning rates at swimming pools among school-age African American children are more than 5 times the rate of white kids the same age. One community in South Miami is doing something about that. Wilson Sayer of member station WLRN has the story.
It's hot out. The usual midday thunderstorm has just passed, and the few kids hanging out on the bleachers around the pool at Ransom Everglades School finally get the go-ahead to jump in and cool off.
Now try that.
8-year-old Gary Kendrick and the others are all here for swimming lessons.
They told us to hold on the wall and kick our feet and move our arms.
Gary says before he knew it, he was swimming on his own.
Then when I had swim to one of the counselors, I was really swimming. I didn't even know I was moving.
He doesn't have the technique of an Olympic swimmer, but Gary can make it to the side of the pool if he's pushed, falls in, or just wants to cool off. And he has fun playing Marco Polo. He's one of a few kids from South Miami to get free swim lessons at Ransom Everglades, a private school with an Olympic-sized swimming pool. The kids, all over the age of 8, all black, are bused over from South Miami's community center one afternoon a week.
You know, we have populations of people who lack basic swim skills.
Julie Gilchrist is a medical epidemiologist at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and she spent much of her career researching child drownings.
In swimming pools, you know, presumably, you know where the bottom is, you know where the sides are. And so one would think that with basic swimming skills, it should be difficult for an older child or a teen to drown in a swimming pool. And yet that's what we were seeing, particularly among African Americans.
Kids who are living in public housing, growing up where finance is a real problem, single mother households, the opportunities just having access to a pool are limited.
Simon Codrington Jr. is on the South Miami Community Advisory Committee, and he's an advocate for the large black community there. Codrington says low-income black kids simply aren't getting the opportunity to learn basic swimming skills. The closest public pool is 3 miles away, and Codrington says that's just too far.
A single mother who relies on public transportation to get around, 9 times out of 10, she's not making a whole, a lot of trips.
So Codrington's long been trying to get a pool built, and after 4 decades, he's finally getting one. The site of the new pool is in the heart of South Miami. They've poured the concrete, but everything else is just mud. Workers dart around in the mid-afternoon drizzle.
This is the pool that's coming up out of the ground, right before your face. Right. Now, let me show you something right offhand.
Codrington points out that this pool will be smaller than the one at Ransom Everglades, where Gary Kendrick is learning to swim. It'll have fewer lap lanes and will be a lot shallower.
For me, it's a mixed bag.
He wishes the new pool were bigger to accommodate things like swim meets and lifeguarding lessons. But he's satisfied knowing it'll be a place where neighborhood kids can learn how to swim.
This is going to save a lot of lives. Just as it is. It's going to save a lot of children from drowning.
The new pool in South Miami is set to open by the time school's out next summer. For NPR News, I'm Wilson Sayre in Miami.
This morning, we're going to begin taking a closer look at the Common Core. Those are the learning benchmarks in reading and math now used in 43 states and Washington, D.C. The standards are controversial and have also led to big changes in schools. The NPR education team set out to capture the sound of that change. Reporter Becky Vivi of member station WBEZ starts us off in a 10th grade English class in Chicago.
About 30 sophomores file into room 313 in Amundsen High School.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, I need everybody's eyes up here, please.
Today, English teacher Nicole Matassa is working on this Common Core standard. Analyze how complex characters develop over the course of a text, interact with other characters, and advance the plot or develop the theme. She's holding a reusable grocery bag filled with random stuff from her apartment. A stapler, a bottle of sunscreen, old school headphones her students barely recognize.
Someone in your group is going to pull out 4 objects, okay? No peeking. and you're going to talk about in your group how each one of those objects could be a representation of a particular character.
The students are about halfway through reading the play A Raisin in the Sun by Lorraine Hansberry. Matassa makes her way around the room, and someone from each group reaches into the bag. Student Sarah Barakal pulls out a box of crayons, perfume, and a bottle of hot pink nail polish. The girls in her group quickly match each object with a character. Mama Younger is nail polish, Ruth is the perfume, and
Walter crayons, because he's bipolar.
And here comes the tougher part, the part that's a cornerstone of the Common Core.
So there's on page 72 where, like, Walter comes in.
Citing from the book to back up your opinions. The girls flip through pages while Matassa wanders around the room. She listens in to each group's discussion and chimes in when she thinks they could go deeper.
Yeah. What else is the thing about nail polish? Do you use the same nail polish color all the time?
No.
No? So it doesn't last forever, right? How can we apply that to Mama?
That she's not going to always be there.
Maybe that's something, right?
I asked student Sarah Barakal why she thinks Miss Matassa wanted them to do this exercise. Her answer, understanding that people are complicated won't just make her a better reader. It could come in handy in real life, too.
Maybe I think this is going to help us later on in the future. We could, like, while we're talking to a person face-to-face, like, we could, like, learn two sides of that person. I don't know.
The point, Matassa says, is to help kids think critically in the classroom and everywhere else. For NPR News, I'm Becky Vivi in Chicago.
As the show approaches its final broadcast on August 1st, we've been checking in with some of the many fascinating guests we've had on the program over the last 7 years, especially people who are making transitions of their own. One of them is Beverly Daniel Tatum, the president of Spelman College, the oldest historically black college for women in the country. President Tatum announced earlier this month that she will retire from the post she's held for the past 12 years. During her time there, she has broken new ground, and not just for an historically black college. She's raised more than $157 million in a decade-long fundraising campaign, started a groundbreaking fitness initiative, and Spelman's graduation rate has risen to 79%, the highest among HBCUs. The school was also named one of the 100 best liberal arts colleges by U.S. News & World Report during her tenure. And Beverly Daniel Tatum joins us now to talk more about her career as well as what lies ahead. Welcome back to the program. Congratulations, I guess, is in order.
Thanks so much, Michelle. So glad to be with you today.
Now, you noted in one interview that 12 years is a long time to be a college president these days. Why is that?
Well, you know, it's a very demanding job. It really is 24/7, 365, every day. And so it takes a lot of energy, and it's hard to sustain that much stamina over a long time. I think the average tenure for a private college president is about 6 or 7 years.
Well, why do you think you've been able to hang in there so long?
Regularly scheduled vacations.
Okay, well, that's good advice. Now, you know, we've talked a number of times on this program about the difficulties faced by institutions of higher education in general, but HBCUs in particular, particularly when it comes to things like fundraising and keeping graduation rates up. And I'm wondering, what is it you think about Spelman that has allowed you, what's been a very difficult environment for many institutions, to not only survive, but thrive?
Well, it's true. It's been a tough time for higher education across the board. But I do think in tough times, donors get more selective. And there have been some characteristics for Spelman that have really helped us. One of those things is that our alumni have really rallied. And so when I've been speaking to donors at foundations or private philanthropists or corporate entities, it's a wonderful pride point to be able to say that our alumni support is so strong. Over the course of this campaign, 71% of our graduates made a contribution. But I also think that our donors recognize that it's a really good investment when they make a donation to Spelman. They know that the students they're investing in are very likely to graduate. We have the highest graduation rate for African-American women in the nation. And we take a great deal of pride in the fact that our cost is still relatively low, but we get a very high rate of return.
What I think I hear you saying is that success breeds success. But what's the foundation of that success? Is it that the experience is of such value, that people have such warm feelings about it, that they just can't help but continue to support the institution and the donors are attracted to that? What is the foundational experience, you think, or foundational issue, you think, that has... That is kind of the basis upon which these other successes have followed?
Well, I think you're exactly right. Success breeds success, but your question is a great one. I think we have a very powerful and compelling mission, and that goes back to 1881, you know, when the founders of the institution said, we are going to create a college or an institution where we're going to educate women who will be leaders and will go back to educate their own communities. That's a very compelling mission, and there's a long track record of success.
I want to ask about the fitness initiative. You closed the school's intercollegiate sports programs, right, to refocus on wellness for the entire campus, not just for students, but also for faculty and staff. And I just wanted to ask, how did you come to that decision, and how hard of a decision was it?
Well, it was initially a challenging decision, but it was one of those moments when I had a stroke of insight, if I might say. We realized that we had a program that was very expensive and benefiting a very small number of students. And there was a moment when I realized that if we reinvested those dollars in a wellness program, we could improve the quality of life for all of our students, particularly when the fact is that adult women, African-American women, are not likely to continue in team sports after graduation. Why continue a high school activity when we could transition them into the kinds of things that adult women do? Yoga, Pilates, fitness walking, jogging. These are the kinds of things that you can do for a lifetime that will help sustain good health.
Was it a difficult decision? I mean, were there tears? I know that you gathered the entire kind of student athlete population together to announce it. Was it hard?
There were indeed tears, and it was hard. You know, it was hard to stand in front of 80 student athletes and tell them that something that they loved was going to be phased out. They were angry with me, but at the same time, I knew it was in the best interest of the institution and ultimately in their best interest. They didn't see it that way immediately, but I'm pleased to say that now our student athletes are still engaged in physical activity and they are enjoying the things that we offer.
Did any of them transfer as a consequence of it? I mean, if they were in Division III, you have to assume that if athletics was a priority of theirs, they would have gone somewhere else like Stanford, for example. But did anybody transfer as a result of it?
I'm not aware of any students transferring. There were a number of students who told me that they were thinking about it, but in the end, every student who said that to me returned the following year.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Beverly Daniel Tatum. She's the president of Spelman College. It's considered one of the top liberal arts colleges in the country. And she's just announced that after 12 years in that position, she's going to retire at the end of next year. You know, to that end, I wanted to ask you if you think that gender plays any role in why Spelman has been able to create this very unique and special place, both, you know, in higher education, the kind of the higher education firmament. I mean, on all these markers, it's graduation rate, it's loyalty, the fact that the alumni are as devoted to the institution as they are. Do you think gender has something to do with it? And if so, what?
I do think gender plays a role in two ways. One, the uniqueness of the institution. There are only two historically Black college for women in the nation. And so being in that unique position, Spelman being the largest of those two, the other being Bennett College for Women in North Carolina, Spelman being the largest and oldest historically Black college for women gives it a special place in higher education. But in terms of the experience of the students who come, that sense of being part of a sisterhood where they're race, their ethnicity, their gender is taken off the table as barriers to their accomplishment, but really a sense of connection and source of pride really is, I think, an important part of the Spelman experience.
Why do you think, though, that among the other markers for Spelman is that the institution has graduated an extraordinarily large number of the African-American women in STEM fields? A large number of them have spent some time at Spelman. Forgive me for bragging for a moment, but, you know, in the spirit of full disclosure, my beautiful and talented stepdaughter is among them. I mean, after having attended Spelman, she's now an MD, PhD. And so why do you think that is? No thanks to me, by the way. I'm just saying. I cannot take credit for that skill set.
The women who come to Spelman who want to do science are at the center of that educational experience. Unlike in a co-ed environment or a predominantly white environment, the students who are at the front of the room in those experiments, hands-on in the labs, are indeed African-American women or women of African descent. So everywhere you turn, if you're a young woman interested in STEM, you see someone who looks like you who is having success. You see faculty members who look like you. You know graduates who have gone on to graduate schools in places that you might like to attend who can reach back and say, come to this place because you can be successful here, as I was. I think the power of the role models and the being at the center of the educational enterprise is very empowering.
Are there lessons that you have learned at Spelman that might be applicable to educational leaders in other environments that are not as unique?
I think setting high expectations and holding students accountable for meeting those expectations is tremendously important. I think, unfortunately, there are lots of environments where young people of color find themselves under-expected, if that's a phrase, you know, where expectations are low, where people don't really expect them to achieve at a high level. But that's not the case at HBCUs and certainly not the case at Spelman.
But why do you think, though, that, for example, the graduation rate at Spelman is a full 20 percentage points higher than at what you might call a brother institution, which is Morehouse College, which is an historically Black, very prestigious and highly selective institution for men, which is right across the street? I mean, any thoughts about why that is?
Well, I think there is a gender factor there, right? We know in general that women are graduating at a higher rate across the board, whether you're talking about Black women or white women. Women are graduating at higher rates than men do. So there is a factor built in there. But I also think that Spelman women have a very supportive environment. That's not to say that it's not very supportive at a men's college like Morehouse, but I think the bonding that occurs among the women is very important. That sisterhood carries young women far and wide, and, you know, there may be a gender factor there. The expectations, certainly the stereotypes that surround Black women's success are different than those that face young Black men.
What's next for you? I mean, it's been reported that you want to update your famous 1997 book, Why Are All the Black Kids Sitting Together in the Cafeteria? It's a book about, you know, having some tough conversations about race. Is that true? Is that part of your plan? And what else is in your future?
Well, it's absolutely true that I'm very eager to think about how the question to that, the question, why are all the Black kids sitting together in the cafeteria, how that question rings in 2014 or 2017, which will mark the 20th anniversary of the publication of that book. And in general, thinking about race relations from the point of view of young people who were born, let's say, in the year 2000. What does it mean to have grown up in the era of the Obama administration, for example? But I'm also quite interested in writing about leadership and thinking about what I've learned as a leader over the course of the last 12, soon to be 13 years at Spelman.
Can you give us a hint, one of those lessons that you might want to pass on about leadership or anything,
you know,
for that matter?
Well, I've really been thinking a lot about what it means to feel a sense of calling. I felt called to Spelman, and there was a tremendous amount of satisfaction in answering that call for the 12 years that I have. And now I feel a sense of time, that it is time to pass the baton. I think, you know, being a good leader is knowing when to say it's time for someone else to lead.
Before we let you go, we have a series on our program called Wisdom Watch, and we ask people who have made a difference through their work and their lives to share some knowledge with us, some wisdom with us. Do you have some wisdom to share?
If there's one piece of wisdom that I feel has been important to me and that I would offer to anyone else, it's to listen to the still voice within.
Okay, what does that mean?
When you sit quietly and meditate on a question or think about something, you know, you asked earlier about intercollegiate athletics. It was in a moment of quiet that I had the realization that we should do something different. And it was in a moment of quiet that I realized it was time for me to step down from Spelman. It was also in a moment of quiet that I realized it was time for me to go to Spelman back in 2002. So I find that listening to that still small voice within in moments of quiet will always steer you in the right direction.
Beverly Daniel Tatum is president of Spelman College. This upcoming academic year will be her last in that position. I do also want to mention that another colleague at another Atlanta-based historically Black college, Dr. Carlton E. Brown of Clark Atlanta University, will also be stepping down next year. We want to wish him well as well. President Tatum was kind enough to join us from member station WCLK in Atlanta. President Tatum, thank you so much for joining us, and best of luck to you.
I wish the same to you. Thanks so much for creating this opportunity.
Yesterday, we reported on charges of plagiarism against a U.S. senator. Democrat John Walsh of Montana is accused of using others' words without attribution in a research paper. He wrote it at the U.S. Army War College back in 2007 when he was an Army colonel. Now a faculty review panel there is investigating. The Army War College has educated some of the military's best-known officers, Pershing, Eisenhower, and Patton. NPR's Tom Bowman tells us more.
The Army War College grew out of the mistakes of war. The Spanish-American War in 1898, soldiers arrived in the island of Cuba with rifles but no supplies. The war plan seemed to change every day. So 3 years later, a school was created to train officers on managing a war. By the 1990s, the college evolved into a school of strategy, a graduate-level look at a more complex world. Only 1 in 5 officers get selected to attend.
The Army War College is essentially the Army's school for generals.
That's retired Major General Robert Scales. He ran the War College for 3 years beginning in 1997 and said the requirements to graduate include a research paper.
Eisenhower's paper was on mobilization, preparing the nation for very large-scale warfare.
Eisenhower was first in his class in 1928.
15 years later, he's doing it.
Then there was a Green Beret officer who wrote a paper in the years before 9/11, warning about an obscure terror group.
We need to start paying attention to Al-Qaeda, even though it seems like just a band of rebels.
Plagiarized papers are rare. Scales recalls 2 students getting kicked out for stealing someone else's work. Another offender had already graduated and had his degree revoked. Scales found that officer's name on a metal plaque.
And literally chiseled his name off the roster of graduates.
Tom Bowman, NPR News, Washington.